Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Mads. Coming up on the program today, construction mafias are now in the government's crosshairs. The public works minister is standing by to talk to us. Johannesburg's power crisis has become a brazen criminal business. 10 billion airline passengers, but no room for 10 billion more. And green funding is flowing, but where are the skills? It's Thursday, the 16th of July. Now, construction extortion has disrupted, I read, more than 180 projects worth an estimated 63 billion rand, driving up costs, delaying essential infrastructure, and potentially frightening off investors. Government has now approved a binding national framework combining tougher law enforcement, contractor blacklisting, and earlier community engagement. I want to pull all of this together. I'm joined by Dean McPherson, who is the Minister of Public Works and Infrastructure. Minister, welcome. And what will this new framework achieve that government has repeatedly failed to do before?
What it does, Jeremy, is it puts communities at the center of defending our construction projects. So previously, what sort of takes place is there has been indifferent or limited social facilitation with communities, which then opens the door for extortionists to come in, either to try and extract directly from projects themselves, or to use communities as a sort of a battering ram for them. And so what we wanted to do is say there are many arms to our policy to deal with construction mafia and extortionists, and this is one of them, and that is to engage communities a lot earlier. It's to make sure that we have a standardization in that engagement. So we actually seek to professionalize the industry. It's really sort of, anyone could do it. You could do it. I could do it. And we can call ourselves social facilitators without having a real curriculum that we would implement. And then to be able to actually ensure that that forms part of the budgeting process for these projects. So it really is a big jump forward. It brings standardization into the process. It brings communities directly into the construction process from the beginning. And we see them as our first right. line of defense now against the mafia.
So in theory, it sounds like a good idea, Minister, but who would appoint, pay and vet these social facilitators, accredited as they are? And perhaps more importantly, how do you stop them from becoming new political gatekeepers?
That's a very good question, and that's why it will be done through our through the Council for the Built Environment, and that registers project managers. So you would have to be accredited by them, just like you would have to be an architect, an engineer, or a QS. You would have to be registered with a professional body. So projects already budget for social facilitation. But as I said, it's done in an indifferent way and it achieves indifferent results. Our argument is that if we, if we have 63 billion rand worth of projects that are delayed because of construction stoppages, well, making sure that the budget that is already allocated for these construction projects is refined in a way that is able to unlock that 63 billion rand. We see that as a spend for good. if we're able to achieve those results. As I said, this is not the silver bullet for extortion and to stop extortion, but it is certainly a big leap forward and forms part of the priorities that we agreed in Durban in November of 2024.
Minister, you'll concede that project liaison committees themselves in the past have been manipulated. I would ask you why the public believes or should believe this new structure or structures that you're outlining are also not going to be captured. There is a risk there, surely.
So, I mean, I absolutely take that point, and that is because there is no formalization to how those project committees, or they call them community liaison officers, are appointed. They're basically picked from the community, that's just done normally by the contractor. And then there's actually no reporting mechanism. There's no standardization of how that process works. So that absolutely does lead to gatekeeping. What we advocate for is a professionally recognized industry of social facilitators that have to meet minimum requirements, that have to obviously then be qualified in the first place to do that job. And then to get that process going. So we're trying to formalize the informal, and we're trying to structure the unstructured. And that's when you do that, that's what takes away the political manipulation that we've seen previously.
Minister, of these 700-odd reported cases, I read around 250, maybe a little bit less, have resulted in arrest. Are you happy with that number? What's happened to the other cases?
Well, I mean, of course, I would like to see any person that stops a project from going ahead, being convicted of a crime. I think it's an economic crime. It's very serious. You know, we can't just treat these as misdemeanors. These are people that are holding the government and communities, by the way, at ransom because they want to seek money out of those projects. So I must say that I was pleased that so many people have actually been convicted, around 161. We're waiting the updated figures, so that will obviously increase. But you may have seen, just this week, I think it was, the mayoral member for safety in Cape Town was saying that they're having to deploy more and more resources to escort contractors in and out. So there's a real cost of not doing anything, which we obviously want to avoid. And the more that we show the public and the extortionists that we are not prepared just to accept their demands, but we will fight back and we will make sure that they go to prison, I think that we will continue to see the decline in those cases over time.
And you've blacklisted, as I understand it, just over 50 contractors, but the problem here is that the directors can simply establish new companies and return through another tender, surely.
Of course, that is a very big risk. I mean, and I would just add, Jeremy, before I came into office, only two contractors were blacklisted in 20 years. We've done 52 in 2 years. So we've shown that we have the political will to get it done. And we have to keep thinking one step ahead of these guys. That's why we work so closely now with provincial governments through our MECs to share that data of not just the companies, by the way, but the individuals. So that when these people pop up and they try and do projects in Limpopo or the Northwest or Gauteng, that they are recognized as well. But it is a continued game of cat and mouse, and that's where we have to use technology to make sure that those individuals are continuously flagged across the various systems and dashboards that we use.
And just finally, about the cat and mice, you've had some success in KwaZulu-Natal. Disruptions have fallen. But is the problem genuinely declining in that province, or, Minister, are the syndicates simply moving to Gauteng and other places?
Look, I mean, it is a cat and mouse, Jeremy. And, while we have seen great results in KZN, I worry, particularly in the city of Cape Town, that is spending an enormous amount on infrastructure. They are the single largest spend of infrastructure in local government, more than two or three other metros combined. So, we're starting to see a shift towards them. Mm. But, we want to work with the city, and I know that they are deploying resources to deal with it. So they do move around where the money is spent. But I mean, I can say on an objective and factual basis that even with the amount of infrastructure that's being built in KwaZulu-Natal, that we see a dramatic decrease in stoppages there.
Dean McPherson is the Minister of Public Works and Infrastructure. Minister, thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Johannesburg's electricity crisis may now be feeding a criminal economy. A Daily Maverick investigation details allegations that infrastructure is now being deliberately sabotaged, components stolen, and desperate residents then pressured to pay private operators to have their power restored. Now, is this simply opportunistic crime or an organized racket exploiting the collapse of city power? Someone who's done excellent work in that respect, investigative journalist at the Daily Maverick, Anna Cox, welcome to you. So, is the sense here that infrastructure is being deliberately broken so residents can be charged to have it repaired? If that's the case, it's outrageous.
Yes, Jeremy, it's quite serious. I think it's a bit of both. I think you're getting the odd person, like we got a video of somebody tearing a cable off a pole and then going to residents and asking for 3,000 rand to restore the electricity. And then I think subcontractors are actually stealing breakers to go and fix people's outages from places where outages have not in fact happened. So they're making a quick buck on the side. These are contractors who know what they're doing because they steal the breakers, they're deliberate parts that they know what they're doing.
So it would beg the question, Anna, how these contractors or syndicates would know which areas are vulnerable and which residents may be willing to play or to pay up.
Well, CPower's got an open website as to where the outages are, so it's fairly easy to access. And then, of course, if you just drive around at night, you can see the areas where the outages are happening.
Who are the people then allegedly collecting the money from the residents? Have you done any work in that respect?
Well, it's the contractors or so-called city power officials. Again, the police can't investigate because unless they're caught doing it, it's very difficult to prosecute. But residents are being approached by people who are saying they're city power officials, whether they are or not is another story, and they say they're contractors to city power. And again, they carry city power badges. So again, it's very difficult to prove who is real and who's not real.
So
that's where the residents are in a dilemma.
What are people paying for then, Anna? Is it an illegal connection? Would it be a faster repair or simply, as that video that you referenced showed, the restoration of a service that they already fund?
It's usually a restoration because people are desperate, completely desperate. I'm currently sitting without power for 4 days and I'm on the verge that I would actually like to pay somebody to restore my electricity. The people are desperate and these contractors or fake city power officials are capitalizing on that and asking residents for up to 1,500 rand to restore. I've got a recording which we're busy cleaning up saying the guy's offering to pay 500 rand and this contractor is saying no, he wants 1,200 rand because he needs to go and get a breaker, he said.
And what would happen to residents or communities who say, no, enough is enough and refuse to pay? Has that happened, do you know?
Yes, then you sit without electricity until the city at its own time decides to come and fix the fault.
So it's understandable then that residents would approach private operators instead of reporting demands to the police because, as you've just referenced, you simply want to switch the light on or put a kettle on.
Correct. You know, you're saving money ultimately. You're not losing stuff from your fridge. And you're desperate, you want a hot bath, you say, here's just 1,500 rand, please reconnect me.
Anna, how widespread do you think this practice is across Johannesburg, which is seemingly on its knees in this respect anyway?
It's increasing. I'm getting daily complaints about this. It's right across Joburg, from the eastern suburbs to the northern suburbs, to Alexandra, to the areas where it is supplied by city power. It's very common. And it's growing because it's an easy target.
And as that video shows, quite brazen.
Absolutely. That was daylight.
So,
and the cameras around and they don't seem to care.
So, Anna Cox, when you put this to city power and the specific evidence and clearer evidence you cannot get, better evidence than from the video that we've seen and that was posted on the Daily Maverick website, what sort of response do you get?
They throw their hands up and say, give us evidence, tell us the time and place, and then you've got to file a police report, and then they've got to go and investigate. So, I mean, it's going to take months to investigate. unless there's absolute evidence, you don't know who the guy is, he's somebody off the street, how are you going to prove who he is?
So to the best of your knowledge, disciplinary proceedings, contract cancellations, arrests, you don't know whether that has happened or not?
It has not happened, no, because nobody's prepared to come forward with any evidence. They're obviously scared, because if somebody comes to try and bribe you, you know, they know where you live. So residents are petrified. They're not going to go and say they've paid a bribe to so-and-so, because they will become targets.
So patently obvious, the city's operational collapse, or city power's operational collapse, is now creating a viable market in which these criminals thrive.
Correct, correct. And as I said, it all boils down to the desperation of residents who are sitting without power. We've had people reporting power outages for up to a month.
Mm. Anna, what will need to change then to break the cycle of sabotage?
Well, we're back to the question of money, which the city doesn't have. They need to obviously invest a lot of money in improving the infrastructure and maintaining it, which they haven't done for years. And once the infrastructure's up and going, obviously things should work normally.
Anna Cox, investigative journalist at the Daily Maverick, thank you very much indeed. It really is a stark picture of what is happening in the city of Johannesburg. Appreciate your time today. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Global air travel demand is expected to double, more than double, by 2050. But the aviation industry cannot simply double the number of airports, runways and border officials. Now, CETA, it's a multinational company providing IT and telecommunication services to the global air transport industry, is arguing that the next great expansion of aviation capacity is going to be built through artificial intelligence, through biometrics and a better use of data. Its latest impact report makes fascinating reading. It points to faster border processing, fewer weather delays and improvements in baggage handling. But here's my question. Can software really solve a physical capacity problem? It's something that over time, doesn't matter where we are, is going to affect all of us. I want to talk about it to Selim Buri, who's president for the Middle East and Africa at CETA. Selim, welcome to you. So is the argument here that software can genuinely move twice as many passengers through airports that are already full? It sounds almost fantastical.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And you have very, very relevant questions to a real challenge. So let's look at it differently. We know that there will be a massive growth, and you listed the numbers. We're going to double in the next 20 years. Actually, even more, and the speed of that in Africa is even higher in terms of yearly growth. Space, at the end of the day, yes, longer term, of course, we will need new aircraft. We will need bigger airports. But the problem is that will take time. So the whole idea here is to make sure that we support the industry to get that time. And the only way to do that is to make sure we can do more with the same. So more capacity of processing passengers on the same space, more capacity of improving the flight operations, improving the aircraft maintenance and consumption of fuel within the same existing generation of aircraft, waiting for this new airport and with this new generation of aircraft that will be delivered over the year. Now, back to your questions, we believe that software will allow you to improve overall the processes to do quicker. And by doing quicker, you will be doing more on the same space, yes.
But it is a balance, as I think you've pointed out. At some point, technology will stop helping and new physical infrastructure and the construction thereof does become unavoidable. So you have to work the two solutions in tandem, right?
Absolutely. It's about solving the today so that we are ready for the tomorrow. In tomorrow, but the tomorrow in the constructions is not about a year or two, we're talking about 10 years. So we need to survive to get into these 10 years. Longer term, yes, of course, there will be mega project, and it is good because this mega project will bring growth, will bring new area and new ways of doing business, will connect new territories. But to get there, we need to survive through the growth. And the growth is not going to happen overnight. It's going to take time. It's going to happen every day, step by step by step by step. So you need to manage that. And it's very important to manage that growth with this capacity of processing. And this is where technology will make a massive difference. So we are talking about using it as a lever to core capacity improvements. We are talking about making sure that within the existing space of an airport, you can process passengers much quicker. Basically, within the airport border, you can also make it much smoother by doing some operations in advance using newer digital travel credentials. We are going to make sure that your existing generation of aircraft will start as of today to consume less fuel, to emit less CO2. We are going to make sure that the trajectories, the turnaround are optimized. And just by doing some simple things, very effective and innovative things, we manage in an airport like Roma, for example, in Italy, to increase the capacity by 30% on the same space. We are managed to do in several airlines to do the savings of tons of fuels. As a matter of fact, our advanced AI optimization tools for the airlines managed to save last year over 2.9 million flights, more than 130,000 tons of fuel. So this technology can make a difference right now, so we are ready for the tomorrow.
The challenges that you point out are universal, obviously, but I'm wondering what the position is in Africa and specifically South and Southern Africa. I presume we would fit into that band, that we would also have to think about this implementation as assertively as other markets.
I think it's even more relevant for Africa. But in Africa, in several areas, we may even start from scratch. So there is a way, if we go with the right technology and the right mix between the physical and the digital, to be smarter from the beginning and much quicker and more efficient. Africa comes with two different challenges, or two higher challenges, a bigger challenge than the rest of the world. There is a challenge of getting access to financing, which is much more difficult in Africa. And there is the challenge of getting the additional growth. The growth that is actually forecasted in Africa will be the double of the rest of the world. We are talking about a potential growth of passenger of 6.9% per year, where in the rest of the world it will be an average of 2.4 or 2.9. So Africa will have more growth and less access to financing, which makes the pure infrastructure part, which is building, a bit more challenging because you will need a lot of money to do that. So doing the right association between the physical part and the digital part is more effective and more relevant to Africa than to any other places.
But you raise a very important point. Can African airports, and specifically South African airports, actually afford these systems? Or do you think the technology gap between richer and poorer markets is simply going to widen?
This is a real challenge, and this is where you need to find the right approach in terms of, you have different ways of getting the financing, and this is very relevant to Africa. You get the traditional way, which is going full financing secured from day one, which is a real challenge, because you need to get access to the funds, you need to have the right structure, and that's not easy, and I may say it's not even fair. There is not a fair access to that. There is the other way, which is finding a right ecosystem, where we'll find a cooperation between the airport and the airline, and sometimes the government, and potentially also the technology partners. And this is where it's very important to have the right technology partner who will come up with the right approach. There is a solution to that, which is a concession model, where the technology partner, and here us at CITA, this is a model we really extend in Africa, we will make the upfront investment. We'll make the upfront investment because we believe in the growth, because we believe in the cooperation, and that upfront investment will be paid over time. So it will be, you may see that as a no tax credit, no interest, because it will be a cooperation. Why CITA does that and not potentially others is because we are owned by the airlines. So we are not, we are a special kind of company. We are owned by the industry, and 100% of our investment is going to developing the industry. So what we want is for people to continue to travel safely, efficiently, and in the most effective way.
All against the backdrop of global air travel demand expected to double by 2050. Selim Bouri, thank you very much indeed from CETA. He's the president for Middle East and Africa. The organization is a multinational company, as I said, providing IT and telecommunication services to the global air transport industry.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, billions are being committed to South Africa's energy transition, all well and good. But money alone cannot install renewable energy systems, modernize the grid, or help farmers adapt to worsening climate risks. A potentially very strong El Nino is also raising fresh concerns about drought, food production, and infrastructure resilience. Now, the education consultancy New Leaf Technologies that works in that space is arguing that South Africa does not yet have enough people with the practical green skills needed to turn climate funding into real, tangible, and working results. Philip Handley is Customer Success Director at New Leaf. Philip, a warm welcome to you. So this green skills gap, is it genuinely holding back the energy transition, or is that just a convenient argument for a training company?
Well, I think certainly it could come across as a convenient argument. But I think from our perspective, you know, it aligns very much with our own mission, which is growing people. But at the end of the day, I think, you know, with policies that come into play, we've seen it in the past that the policymakers and the funding don't quite keep up the training that actually needs to happen. So what happens is the money is ahead of the actual workforce. So you can fund the infrastructure, but actually at the end of the day, you also need to fund and deliver the training to run and maintain it.
So in that respect, then, would we be short of entry-level workers, experienced technicians, engineers, project managers? Where is that deficit gap?
Well, I imagine it's in every aspect. So with the infrastructure, of course, it's new technology that's coming in. So with the just energy transition, that's also moving away from fossil fuels, so typically where we've been quite strong, moving into the more renewable space. So it's a completely new area for probably the majority of the country. And I think, you know, with the energy transition, trying to make sure that those people transitioning from coal still have the opportunity to earn, you know, in the places that they live, like in Mpumalanga. So, yeah, absolutely. Mm. It'll be in every aspect.
And Philip, can you make the link between that lack of skills and the final impact on the project, which might not actually get underway? What would the consequence be of that failure in the supply chain?
Well, I think, you know, I can probably reference the University of Pretoria. They did some research where they said that if we don't act now, then there's potential for between 28 and 36 billion cost by 2030. So that number really moves based on how fast we react as South Africa. So acting now will really bring that number down.
South Africa, Philip, already spends, as I understand it, heavily through the sector education training authorities, the SETAs. Why do you think that system has not produced the required workforce that you're referencing?
It's a very good question. And I mean, I wouldn't want to necessarily criticize the SETAs, because I think they're doing a lot in trying to update their delivery mechanisms. But at the end of the day, I think the SETAs have quite a lot of unspent budget that goes to waste because of the delivery capability. You know, we can't build buildings fast enough or training institutions in every town. And really, we believe that the digital side of things means that we can reach people where they are. It can be self-paced. You know, there are various different ways that you can reverse the billing side of things. So you have data-free URLs so that everybody can access it. But really on the SETA side, they're moving quite slowly in the sense that, you know, it's very administrative, very paper-based. And so it takes a lot of time outside or away from the people that could actually make an impact, the instructors, the assessor process, the portfolios of evidence. That's a very tedious process.
As I see it, the clock is really ticking here. At the start of this conversation, Philip, I referenced El Nino. How quickly do you think green skills training can make a difference if something like El Nino is going to affect agriculture this coming season? More haste is required here, surely. More.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I heard on you say the other day that AI comes into every conversation, but really it does allow us to deliver training material at a much faster rate in terms of setting up a, let's call it a learner management system or some sort of WhatsApp delivery mechanism. Those things are becoming much easier due to the fact that technology is advancing so much. So technology, where it used to be the problem, let's say back in 2015, is no longer the issue. Really, at the end of the day, it's about finding the people to train and delivering it to those people where they are.
And Philip, what I'm trying to get my head around is who actually decides what qualifies as a green skill and which courses ultimately employers would need to recognize?
Yeah, so I think probably there are three or four different roles within that. I think corporates, they really bring the workforce needs to the CETAs. The CETAs, of course, would be in charge of the funding and the accreditation, but then the government really is in charge of the policy. From our perspective, we sit as the delivery mechanism, almost in the middle. So it would be those four elements, I'd say.
And ideally, who pays for this training? Is it government, employers? Do you hope for international donors? Or is it the person themselves who's trying to reskill?
Yeah. So I think it depends. So whether or not the person is doing an accredited training program or not, typically that funding does come through the CETAs. With a Just Energy Transition, they are mainly funding the infrastructure side of things. And so the responsibility would fall on the CETAs to ensure that there's funding. And of course, your businesses would get, you know, quite good or hefty tax back based on how they're training their people up.
Thank you very much indeed. I think it's a very important conversation, particularly at this juncture. Philip Handley, thank you. Customer Success Director at New Leaf Technologies. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb. Your trusted source for business and investment insights.